Hey everyone, welcome back to the Blessed Child Podcast. This is your host, Renee, aka Ren Robot. In this interview, I will talk with a new guest. Her name is Nicole. We talk about a range of topics going from Madison Square Garden to the recent overturn of Roe vs. Wade, Sean Moon's visit to Japan, and women's health, as well as systemic oppression, domestic abuse, and domestic, child abuse. These topics are not easy to talk about. So make sure you're safe when you listen to it. Now, I am recording this on July 15th, 2 weeks after I did this interview. I've taken a little break from Blessed Child Podcast because of recent events. If you haven't heard, the ex-prime minister of Japan was assassinated by Tetsuya Yamagami. Tetsuya Yamagami stated that Shinzo Abe had a relationship with the Unification Church, and he has a grudge against the Unification Church due to the Unification Church leading to his family's bankruptcy and their demise. His brother committed suicide, and his dad also, I don't know if committed suicide or died somehow. But there is a lot of tragedy behind Tetsuya's backstory, which I think a lot of us can relate to. The Unification Church led to a lot of bankruptcies in a lot of families and the complete destruction of a lot of our families. I do not personally have any roots with my family. My parents don't talk to me. My Japanese side has disowned me. So yes, I understand Tetsuya's anger. And that anger usually is turned inwards. Many of us that have grown up in the Unification Church have self-destructive habits to cope with the abuse we have gone through. Many of us have committed suicide. A few of my friends personally, most of the time after someone survives this kind of oppression, they turn inwards. And Tetsuya actually attempted suicide. So it's not that he didn't, it's just that he's had enough. And I understand that. I think anybody that has survived the Unification Church can understand that. Especially when the people you run to, like the government, the FBI, the CIA, especially when you tell these people about this human trafficking organization and they invalidate it. And there's been no coverage. Like on a global scale, the Unification Church is the most gaslit organization. Like the abuse in the Unification Church is the most ignored abuse on a massive scale. It's ridiculous. Like it's absolutely ridiculous. Why? Because these people that you run to for help, they're paid. They're paid off. The Moonies line their pockets. And that's seen with the Rally of Hope. I mean, Donald Trump, Mike Pence, Steve Bannon with Sanctuary Church, Abe himself. These people have been paid. So what choice did Tetsuya have? Like, really? I mean, yes, we all have a choice not to be violent. That is a choice. I'm not going to go so far as to call him a hero for spotlighting the abuses in the Unification Church, but he did a massive service to the ex-Muni community because now we have a huge spotlighting on the Unification Church and they are backed into a corner. So it's been a lot to process, and I guess I'll give you a rundown of what's been coming to light. In Japan, there are ex-Moonies doing interviews left and right and bringing awareness to the stories of oppression in the Unification Church under Moon's imperialistic reign. We have the National Network of Lawyers Against Spiritual Sales that are thoroughly deconstructing the coercive tactics on a national scale in Japan. I think they're doing a great job. We've got ex-Moonies stateside going on different podcasts. One of them I'll link in the show notes. It's the Faith and Capital podcast. There's a episode called Ex Muni Anti-Imperialism, Unification Church and the Assassination of Shinzo Abe. We've got Ex Munis trending on Twitter, TikTok, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram. The Mooniverse is finally getting the attention it deserves as an oppressive organization and human trafficking, labor trafficking organization. He is able to look up government contracts and has revealed that Reverend Moon was actually one of the lowest bidders, and the government signed many contracts with him through the Department of Defense for labor, specifically with Master Marines Inc. and Bayou LaBattery. And so it looks like the government has also gotten honeypotted with the Moons, and that the governments all around the world actually contract labor out to the Moons, because what's cheaper than labor trafficking? Literally nothing. Hopefully somebody can look up government contracts with Tongil Heavy Industries out of Korea, because they have revenue over $1 billion a year, and they're also a Moon-based company. So yeah, there's a lot of activism going on. There's a lot going on, and it's overwhelming. I just wanted to come on this podcast and remind you that you are not alone. I know it feels like we are alone because we don't have that physical community that we grew up with, but a lot of Moonies and ex-Moonies are bringing light to the abuse in the Unification Church. It's undeniable. And hopefully, you know, what's to come of this? Hopefully the Moons be held accountable for all their human trafficking. Hopefully the Moons start paying Social Security and retirement to all the first gen that they labor trafficked. Like, yes, there's an extreme imbalance of power, and it needs to be balanced. So let's balance those scales. Keep talking. There are also Moonies that are also equally activated, and I want to remind everybody that this is a difficult time for everyone involved with the Unification Church, and the best thing to do is to go forward with kindness. There is going to be a lot of uprooting happening, and yeah, you can never go wrong with being kind. So yeah, try to practice that. And without further ado, let's go into the interview with Nicole. I hope you enjoy it, and remember to take care of yourself as you listen. Here we go. Today, I have Nicole with me, and I am so honored to be talking with you today after getting to know you for almost 2 years now, or is it just one and I just think it's longer?
It's felt like a lot. I think it was
a year and a half.
March 2021. It was shortly after the January 6th riot, when all of us were all just like riled up after we saw Sean Moon on the
right Capitol. The right. Political polarization in America led by a freaking Moonie. Yeah, that triggered the shit out of me. I think actually on January 20th is like when Falling Out dropped, and that's the same day I painted that painting with Trump and Moon.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, boom.
I was pretty moved by how rapidly we all simultaneously started looking for each other. I had spent a couple years, and sort of long term, I had had interest in finding other ex-second gen survivors, especially queer ones. I was looking for that sort of in my head. Like, I know they're there and I'll talk to them at some point, but like in earnest in like fall of 2020. Yeah. Fall 2020, I actually like messaged multiple people who like knew ex first generation members, but that just really wasn't the flavor I was after. And it just hasn't been something that I felt as supported by. So I was really grateful to meet you and just how ferociously you are approaching everything, because I've had a lot of people kind of like gingerly or softly like intellectualize or like minimize a lot. And yes. And it was nice to have you. I'm also a visual artist, so having you speaking visually was something I was like, okay, got it. I see what you're saying. And, you know, I've made a lot of art that's like visceral and raw like that too. So it was like, cool.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Can we just take a moment to like shout out your art if there's any plugs you want to do? Because your artwork is truly moving and multidimensional. And it's just from a cult survivor lens, it's just so deep. And I understand like the psychology behind it. And I love it because it's very raw and real and gritty. And it takes you to like some dark places, but also has this like interdimensional travel feel where you're healing and you're also hurting and you feel it all at once. That's why I love your art.
Oh, thank you. That's awesome. I don't know plugging myself. I have a website. It's nicoleceleste.co.uk. .com was taken, and also I have a bunch of family in England, so it's like I feel like I can justify it. And
awesome.
And then my Instagram is at Nicole Celeste Art. And you know, it's funny because so much of like my grittiest stuff is not even online. I need to like embolden myself to put more of that out there. But it's funny because I oscillate between so many mediums. And I have done a lot of healing. So like I'm a parent of four children. So I have a lot of like sort of hearth space, womby, floral, like happy stuff. And then I've got like really gritty trauma stuff. And sometimes it's hard. I almost think I need to like create multiple accounts. And then I also have a lot of sexual stuff, which most of that I don't put online either. So it's like, I think it speaks to the framework of, you know, femininity and what's accepted and what's not, and how it almost feels like you're doing something wrong if you put the wholesome mom out there and you put the like sensual slutty and you put the like, you know, raw abuse art all in the same place. It's like, what?
No.
You know, so it's like cultivating a public image has been something that I haven't quite figured out. And I'm also like juggling my baby, who's almost 5 months old right now. So if he squawks, that's
you're literally holding a baby right now. I love your Instagram because you're creating space for all those nuances that are very real in being a cult survivor and having children, like that very new identity of having children and coming into that maternal aspect of life, and also trying to heal your inner child while also holding space for the injuries that you carry. You know, I love it. I love it. I'm so glad we could plug it because it's awesome. If you guys feel inspired, go visit Nicole's pages. I'll plug them in the show notes.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
That was a big intro.
For sure. let's see. Okay. So, today marks the 40th anniversary. Today, what is it? July 1st, 2022 yeah. marks the 40th anniversary of the Madison Square Garden blessing.
Yes. Yeah. So I have been talking to Renee for like off and on for months, like, hey, we should do it. Oh, never mind. I can't, I'm busy, you know, graduating or whatever. But I was like, I need to do it now. This is the blessing ceremony my parents were married in. And so many people I know have parents who are married in this one. And somehow it just feels like a big deal to me that it's the 40th anniversary.
Yeah. And it's really crazy because my whole day was scheduled, booked up. I had appointment after appointment. And for some miraculous reason, all my appointments showed up at 10 o'clock in the morning. So I got I got my appointments done, and boom, by 2, I'm free. And this is like, just, you know, as a, if any Moonies are listening, this is spirit world.
Okay. So I want to say something about that.
Yeah.
I still like ride intuition waves all the time. Oh, and yeah. So part of what's tricky, I think, about being a cult survivor is that your sensory information, which for me includes my intuition, is something that was abused. So I think for a lot of people, it feels safest. And obviously you could have the framework or belief system that just doesn't align with that, but it feels safest to sort of go directly to, you know, atheism, or just like not believing in anything supernatural or surreal or, you know, magical realism feeling, because when that's been so profoundly manipulated, it just feels off limits. So I was just thinking about that as a sensory experience, because for me, my intuition, my perception of spirituality is just as sensory as my taste and smell and everything else. But those things were equally manipulated. So in a cult, people will manipulate your desire, your hunger, your thirst. And so I just think it's a relevant point that intuition is another sense that can be distorted, or, you know, you can be told that what you're feeling and thinking is just the opposite of what it is. And I think for me, what actually got me out was how intense my intuition is. And I was like, I'm going to go for that rather than what you guys are saying, because this is too, sorry, excuse me, my eldest child just walked into the room. Hi, I'm doing a recording now as an interview, and your dad's not back yet. So if you could give me some audio space, please. I don't really have anywhere to go, and I'm trying to keep the baby from crying. Okay. Okay, I can't take you bowling today. Okay, got it.
That's cool. Bye. That's cool. No, I totally get it. Actually, I want to touch on this a little more with the intuition. Actually, I read about this, that Darwin called it the pneumogastric nerve. Is like basically, you know, when you see somebody you're attracted to, you get butterflies. When you are angry, man, let's see. You see somebody you're attracted, you get butterflies. Your gut tells you, like, you'll get gut pain when you're stressed out. Yeah. You'll feel chest pain when you're grieving. This is called the pneumogastric nerve, is what Darwin called it. And it's actually part of your nervous system. Yeah. Actually, the gastric system is where most of your serotonin is held. So this theory backs up, and it's later been developed into what's known as the vagal nerve, which is controls heart rate and breathing.
Yeah.
And you can tap into it to soothe yourself. So actually what I'm coming into understanding is that your nervous system isn't just your brain. It's actually very much your gut,
your whole body
is related to your heart. And so when we were raised in the cult, we were taught mind over body, but really there is no difference. The mind is the body. The body is the mind, very much with neurotransmitters, with different receptors. And like, I am learning to trust my gut, is what you're calling it. Trust your gut, but yes, your intuition, which processes a whole bunch of emotions and information so much faster than your brain can. That's what your vagal, that's what your body is doing. Like, your body has wisdom.
Right.
It's and it's taken me so many years to heal and to understand that is a thing, because in the church it teaches you to ignore your body, and I'm like, that you lose so much innate wisdom when you're brought up that way.
Right. I think that's a really powerful point, and I always like to reframe mind over body wherever I see it as mind and body collaborating, because that is how they don't need to be in opposition. Like, they're on the same set of goals. Like, if your like wholeness and safety is what you're striving towards, you know, and just general well-being, your body is in alignment with that. You don't have to like grab it and twist it and force it to do that. It's going to naturally do that for you.
That's the beauty of life. So beautiful.
Yeah. And for me, I think my relationship with my intuition was very much tied to my creativity. Oh, hi, baby. And being a visual artist, or all different kinds of artists. But I was just thinking about that in relation to your art. Because even when you can't articulate with words something that's not acceptable, you can still communicate it through your art. And so I always say, for me, like, I also like to do creative writing. I actually, this week was, I submitted for my first time an essay that actually has to do with the Madison Square Garden blessing. And I'll probably get rejected because that's how the statistics work for that. But I did it. I officially did it for the first time, submitted writing. But anyway, for me as a writer, my visual art always comes first, because it's like, I map out my subconscious with my visual art, and then I can look at it. And then after I can look at it, I develop the language to understand it. So it's like a multi-part process, but like, creativity is such a direct vein to what's actually going on. So I'm always, whenever I meet people, I'm like, so what? Like, what's your creative drive about? And a lot of people are like, I'm not creative. And then, you know, you find out that they're like, you know, they brew like kombucha, or like they grow plants, or they bake they bread. It doesn't music. Really,
yeah,
whatever it is. Yeah. And it's, so for me, I'm always like, I'm on this, like, validate people's creativity.
Absolutely.
I don't know.
Absolutely. Yeah. I don't like, yeah.
I like shy away from the word mission, but I'm like, I might even be a little bit antagonistic about it. I try not to be, but I'm like, you're creative. I know you are. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. I say when people tell me like, oh, I'm not creative, like, you're so talented, I can't even draw a stick figure.
I'm
like, stop. You can. You're just not interested. Also, like, this is just not something that interests you.
Draw a stick figure. And then draw another stick figure.
Yeah.
And then draw a speech bubble. Like, what are they saying to each other? Like, it does not freaking matter if it's a stick figure. Like, it's a means to communicate. Just like dancing is a means to communicate.
Exactly.
Singing, talking, like, it's just another method. You don't have to be able to monetize it for it to be a means to communicate with yourself or other people.
Right. It's like this gift. Our body can create language without words, creativity.
That's what,
and everybody has it. I don't want to limit it to just drawing. It's everywhere.
Right. Right.
Human beings are innately creative beings. On that point, you did do a portrait of me, which is so encouraging and empowering. And when you did that, I felt like really supported to do this podcast. We'll probably make it the episode art, because it's really empowering.
Okay.
Because I really loved how we were talking about how we found each other with the XMooney hashtag, because I was also in that same place. Like, I was honestly on cruise control, just trying to repress what had happened because it didn't seem real. Because nobody was validating the experience of ex-Mooney cult survivors. So I didn't think I could talk about it. But yeah, then Sean triggered like a tsunami of reaction, because we were like, not this shit again. Not this shit again.
For real.
Hey everyone, we took a little break and we're coming back to pick up where we left off. And the last thing we talked about, I brought up the queer ex-Mooney hashtag. And I was wondering about the history of that and how you partook in that with the creation of your art and the visibility that you've created for the queer ex-Mooney community. Cause I think that's amazing.
Okay. Hi. Yes. So, I definitely want to give credit to Lex. Her Instagram is @_salty.lex. I think I said it right. But she's the one who was like, we need a hashtag. And so then she came up with it. I started posting about my experiences as a second gen who left the church, who was queer. And then Yusei was doing a live stream on Instagram with, why can't I think of her name? You know.
Was it Faith?
Yes. Sorry, Faith. Yes. So Yusei and Faith were on there. And then Lex and I were just being all silly in the comment section. So that's how we became friends. And that's when we came upon the like secret, I don't think it's secret anymore, like collection of queer ex-Moonies that already existed. And that after that, we both joined that. And then she was like, we need a hashtag so that everyone can find us easily. And So she came up with Queer Exmoney, and then I was like, that's awesome, and I'll make art. And then I did. I don't know if there's a longer story than that. But anyway, lots of people have been using it since. And yeah.
All these people I have a soft spot for all of you guys. I was so proud when you guys all came out, and I was like, oh yes, affirmation, validation, like different, like, yeah, we have, we're sexual beings and we have different spectrums, and like, yes, I loved it. So cool. Lex was one of the first people to affirm my deviation from the gender norm. And so that really was an empowering moment for me. So yeah, thank you, all of these people we've named, for making a safe place for exploration.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I want to put your artwork that you made. I love it. How you put a person, like a non-binary person, breaking out of the Unification Church gates with like a rainbow in the background. Maybe that one should be this episode's cover art, because that one is just iconic.
There are so many choices. Today is the 40-year anniversary of the Madison Square Garden wedding, so I think maybe the one with you on it is a good pick.
Yeah,
because it's a blessing image that's also comparing it to a chessboard. And so,
let's talk about that if you don't mind.
I don't mind. So yeah, I have a funny relationship with this whole queer exmoney second gen thing, in that it feels like really far away for me. So I left a long time ago. For a long time, I didn't even really realize that that was something I particularly needed to process. So much of my focus in my trauma healing was specifically processing my relationship with my dad. And it's only been more recently that I've realized the church environment really contributed a lot to those dynamics. I'm not saying I would have had a little green pastor's childhood with him as my father, even outside of the church, because I wouldn't have. But yeah, it's... I guess a lot of people I know who left the church were very kind of neutral. They weren't like the polarized, like angry ex-Moonies from, I feel like that's like a characterization of the first generation, was this idea, you know, the ones who left, it was like, oh, they just like to debate a lot. You know, the vibe I'm talking about, it was almost like.
They were shunned. Oh, they were stigmatized. They failed.
Right. No, totally. But from the perspective of while you're still in, it's like, oh, what are they on about? Like if they had left, like, why do they care so much that they're like talking about it all the time? You know, what are they so grumpy about? You know what I mean? Like, just move on, sort of. Mm-hmm. So I feel like my mom's approach was more like neutral. And so after she left, I didn't really delve too deeply into it for a long time. I thought it was weird, but I also thought lots of things are weird. And I thought in some ways that it was sensationalized, because if you look at most other long-standing monotheistic religions, you've got the same handful of like slut-shaming and controlling and, you know, monogamy, purity, you know, purity culture is rampant. And as a teenager, I was like, okay, this isn't singular to the church that I'm in. And in some ways it desensationalized it for me. I was like, whatever, everybody's doing it. And so it's kind of like everybody's rebelling against it too. So yeah, I don't know what my deal was, but I I wasn't particularly, you know, the argument, there was always this debate, is it a cult or is it not a cult? And it's like, look, we're just like all these other religions. And it's true, there are a lot of other religions that are like that. And so for me, it was like, yeah, I'm not really into any of this. Although simultaneously, I had a sincere reverence for a lot of the pieces of the church. And so I guess that actually is a relevant point, because when I decided it really wasn't for me, I didn't do so from a place of scorn exactly. And so it was almost like I was worried about my friends like, especially they were in a kind of radicalized subgroup of the church. But I was like, if I have concern and I voice it, seeing that I'm already fallen and I've already left the church, like, of course I would object. That's like the cliche script of a fallen person. So they don't want to hear it from me, was kind of my logic. I was like, I don't need to deter them from their spiritual path if that's what's right for them. So in a lot of ways, I just sort of was in this liminal space between like secular and, you know, plus child. I was, you know, I, so I fell when I was 15, and then I sort of, you were mentioning earlier the word masking. So I was masking purity. I was masking with this sort of performance of piousness and purity. Well, it's funny though, because it was also sincere, as in I've always been extremely I put a lot of effort into trying to figure out the right thing and do the right thing and live by my ethics and stuff like that. So it wasn't actually, it wasn't fake. It was just, I was like hiding the fact, like I'd had sex. And also some of that was not good. Like, and that's the mind fuck too, is when you're in a purity culture, there's no differentiation between like appropriate boundaries, enthusiastic consent, and like the other end, like overt rape. If it's all just, oh, you fell, then there aren't any dialogues for self-protection. So for me, when I first had sex, it was not enthusiastic consent by any means. I wouldn't call it rape either, but it was like, okay, that fucking happened. I guess I'm a fallen blessed child now. And I guess I'll have fun with it. So then I had fun. And I explored my sexuality. I was like, what's, it's done is done. The church was so, it drove it home so fucking hard that as soon as you fell, that was it. That I had no goal for redemption whatsoever. Also, I had seen my mom leave my dad. And so she was viewed as fallen too. So I had this whole script of how people treat fallen people that I've been on the other side of since I was 7. So like everyone talking about like my mom being fallen for leaving my dad, and that being what we prayed about every morning and every night at Mundoke and at like 5 a.m. And so like when I was like, oh shit, I fell, that was it. I had already seen how people were treated at that point, and I had no hopes for redemption. But simultaneously, I didn't really feel like I'd gone that far. It was like this sort of disorienting, I don't actually believe in this experience. It was like, I realized I didn't believe in it when I didn't really feel doomed. I didn't really feel like the floor drop out from under me. I was like, you know what, actually, I don't think these fallen stakes are as big as they make them out to be. So that's all, like you could jump into like hundreds of different talking directions with that. But
I just really appreciate you being super honest about all those different, it sounds like, yeah, ego destruction of like a false ideal. And then finding out that there was no like shards of glass and hell fire on the other side, besides just isolation, loneliness, and then having to fake purity. And like, I'm sorry you didn't have a support system when that happened, you know, like the reality of it is like you were alone.
I was even alone in the sense of, you know, I know secular is a church term, but even with my secular friends, because even consent dialogues in, you know, mainstream culture outside of the church were also pretty absent. So there wasn't a clear illustration of something that's, you know, not rape and not, enthusiasm consent wasn't even like a term that I was had any relationship with. And also, you know, sex is so described as recreation for men. And so
when you're not, you know, like so many women, oh my God, that aren't even in the church, spend years having like non-pleasurable sex because they think of it as something that they're offering or giving rather than something that they're collaboratively enjoying. That was not the case for me. So yeah, it was not like an enthusiastic consent initial event. If anything, I felt kind of some death goddess rage. I was kind of like, I don't know, like I don't know how detailed I should get, but I was on a very specific, in a very specific headspace. I'll say that much.
Man, there's so many breakaways we could have here. Yeah, I feel like, I feel like it's so important to tell the listener out there, if they are engaging in borderline consensual sex, like there is a beautiful way of having sex, and it's when you both achieve like orgasm or at least pleasure or at least like fun and sensual, like exploration and connection. That's for me, right. For me, that's now the new, what's a standard of sex, when before I had been in that place where it was very like performative and I didn't even know like how fun my body could be.
Right. I wouldn't say I was performative. I'll just get more detailed, 'cause you know what? Fuck it. Yeah. I don't know.
It's important.
I'm just feeling really so much reckoning rage energy. Like Roe versus Wade, yep, being overturned, and fucking Sean Moon fucking slut shaming his mom, like saying she married the devil. That is slut shaming. Let's just highlight that. And I'm cussing a lot, and I could tone it down, but okay.
Yes. So for the record, for people that are not sure, first I'm going to do cult translation. So falling means having sex, premarital sex. Okay. But also with, Sean Moon, he has been for, I don't know, years now calling his mom, not the true mother, that she slept with the devil. She cheated on Moon, slept with the devil, lost her legitimacy and her divine like authority, and replaced her with somebody named Hyun Shil Kang, like literally like photoshopped her face out of his family pictures and put this other bitch's face in the pictures. I'm like, dude, how spiteful can you be, man? That is your mom, right? Unless there's something else going on with the tragedy of the six Marys and somebody else got pregnant. Like from what I know, Sean's mom is Hak Ja-han, but maybe she's not. I don't know.
Well, even so, it's an illustration of the gender dynamics of the church.
Right.
Like there, it is very much like women are to submit, like women are object. Like there are so many illustrations of you better perform good. And even if you do, we will scrap you whenever we fucking want to.
And just take your picture out of all the history books. Like that's what they're doing. It's crazy.
So yeah. I'm riding this energy where I'm like, how much do I want to say?
Yeah.
It's just that the being fallen, the energy that I was in as I left, so the energy of falling. I know it's a concept. It's something that
it's a stigma. Falling.
It's something we were taught that was happening, but the energy that I had in that moment, I find really interesting. I was with someone who was like repetitively pushing me. He was like, if you love me, wouldn't you have sex with me? He was like, please, please, please. And I was like, no, no. And then I was just like, fine. That was literally how that happened.
Fine.
And he was wearing a condom, and it was in my dad's room on his bed. It was just like, fuck you, dad. And also fuck you, boyfriend. And so he came in like 2 seconds and it hurt. And I had like laughter in my heart. It was like, you know, death goddess bitch energy. And I'm not ashamed of that.
Wow.
So then after that, I'm like, oh shit, I'm really fucking queer. And I had a whole really tender romance with a woman, but it was almost just like, fuck all of you men first. And also I had a lot of recreational sex with that guy after he sort of, I guess, coerced me into it.
I was like, you know what? I'm fallen. So this is going to be for me. And I keep running this whole thing through the framework of the abusers that are listening, because that's what happens when you speak out, is all the abusers perk up and stick their ears right over and listen to everything you say. So I'm always speaking from the position of being stalked and being absorbed and being run through their system. So they're like, look, that's the devil talking. And it's like, you can think that if you want, but I recreationally had sex everywhere after that. On the golf court, on the golf course, in the stairwell at school, outside, in the trees, like everywhere.
Yep.
And I had a lot of orgasms, and I knew what my body liked way before anyone could try to fucking marry me off.
Nice.
So if you need your purity shattered, here's your little rage laughter for that.
Oh man. Nice.
So after that, after that, I had one of these like really, really dear best friend who was not in the church, who I was super close to. I had multiple deep relationships, but anyway, this friend, we were super creatively collaborating, and I was standing in front of her in the bathroom. We were like brushing our hair, and I was looking at her in the mirror, and I was like, I'm attracted to you. That was how I came out to myself. I was 16 years old. It was like my subconscious just totally diverted the whole thing. So I was already fallen as fuck by then. And I did not give a shit about being queer on behalf of purity or not, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
And then it was like, oh, this is what good love feels like. Not that. I was essentially redeeming it. Had I not had the church construct of like, oh, you fucking lost this pure thing, maybe I wouldn't have tried to get the bang for my buck, haha, bang. But because he sort of coerced me into it, and then I was like, oh, I'm a fallen child now. I was like, well, I better ride this until it's as fun as it can possibly fucking be. And so that was what I did. And then I had a relationship with my friend that was mostly not physical, but it was extremely intense. Lots of edging. Anyway. I'm here to say that I'm not ashamed of being sexual. And if any other people are still hovering in their little cloying purity, maybe that'll rattle you a bit. I know it'll rattle the people who are still in.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like the boomerang effect. Like you've been, people have an aversion to extreme, like authoritarian control. And like, mm-hmm. that's how we grew up. So it just builds like a shaken soda. And then consensually or non-consensually, when that cap comes off.
Right.
Yeah. It explodes. And it doesn't have to be that way, but that's what happens under pressure, like under authoritarian control. Yeah.
Right. And that's something that I would also advise everyone to track, is taking actions that are for you and not, because sometimes the only way to break out of something is making a rebellion that's such the polarized extreme of what you're told to do, that it's actually not only rebelling against whatever it is you're fighting, but it's also actually crossing your own body's boundaries, if that makes sense.
No, so yes.
Learning how to take up your space of bodily agency by doing what your body wants, as opposed to like, I'm going to do everything they ever told me not to do. Because if you're just going to as the far extremes of that, you could end up crossing your own needs and body. So I think that the obviously do whatever the fuck you want, but cultivating a relationship with actually listening to your body is so important. And it's just as, what's the word? Like, it has just as much friction and tension and rebellion in it, just to sit and listen to your own body, as say like going on a 3-day like bender or whatever. Like just sitting there and listening to your body is such an act of rebellion, and then taking steps from there. Like it's like scary. It's scary to know what yourself is saying. So anyway, I don't know if that's helpful. I just think that
leaving control systems, it's so important to tune in as quickly as possible to your inner voice that you've been stuffing away. And for me, art was always that shortcut for that. And whatever means you can take to get there, and obviously shatter what you need to shatter. If your acts of rebellion involve just trashing your own body to get out, sometimes people do that. So I'm not trying to shame the people who've had to do that to leave, because I know people, it was just like, it was almost like, I'm going to make myself so unredeemable that you'll never want me back. And I know more than one person that's, you know, rebelled against purity culture in that way. And I guess my point is, I took that relationship as a ticket psychologically out. That was my first ticket out. But then it was still possible for me to fall back into the church ideological script a little bit. Like when I was 18, I went on a trip with some church members, and because I had broken up with that guy, but then I ended up being with him again briefly, but because there were, you know, dysfunctional dynamics in the relationship, then some of the church script of like purity or like evil or sin would line up, because there was the truth in me that's like, yeah, that's not good for you. But I would only let the sort of, you know, the whole spiel, the whole sort of sincere reaching, trying to bring out the best in you. Let's just find this one true thing bit that church members do. And then if they can hook on to any of your truths, they try to drag you away with it. I don't know if you know what I'm saying. So I was like, you know what? That is true. I shouldn't be in that relationship. But then I had this other relationship with this woman who I was in love with. And it was like, okay, you're right. When I was 18, I'm like, you're right. I shouldn't be with that guy. That was my takeaway from the trip I was on. But I'm also like, you guys are all still full of shit. And this love is tender and real and much more real than any kind of manipulation you could try to pull on me. And therefore I'm still not gonna bite. But it took a lot of work because I was isolated. Church people always try to, not just this church, any controlling cult, like isolation coupled with repetitive, you know, bombardment with ideological constructs, while deteriorating, you know, minimizing or somehow taking down what it is that you already have in your life, like that's how they get the foot in the door. So yeah, I had already like mentally left, and pretty, you know, pretty visibly physically left, because I lived with my mom when I was 18. That's a whole other story. But I moved out of my dad's house, and so I wasn't really I was hardly going to church at all at that point.
Can we just clarify for the listener, was your mom in the church or was she out of the church? Your parents got divorced.
Sure. Sorry, I'm jumping all over the place.
No. So, well, I'll make sure it's cohesive. We'll get it.
Yeah, my mom left my dad when I was 7. And I think she was under the impression that he would behave reasonably and ethically and honorably. You know, she was like, you know what, I can't do this anymore. And he definitely did all the trademark moves of someone who's trying to regain as much control as possible. So she had the intention, I think, of watching me and my siblings once she got in her own place. But instead, he framed it entirely as her abandoning us and him. And he used us as bait and ammunition. And he, for a period of time, kept us away from her for an entire month to try to, you know, blackmail her back into the house. And, you know, he had a lawyer like sort of paint her as like mentally unwell, at least that's my understanding of that. And she didn't, you know, she had been a stay-at-home mom. So he had a lot more money, and he used that power and the trust she'd put in him, like having us stay there while she moved out for any period of time. He used that all to his, you know, control tactic advantage. And so, yeah, for a year, because of that, he skewed the custody arrangement so that she didn't have very much access to us for a while. But that was definitely I think that's part of why I had so many more choices than other people in the church because my mom left. So there was the part where, yeah, she was fallen and then there was that shame around that. But there was also the part where every other weekend, instead of being at church, I was at my mom's house. And that was a pretty dramatic break from being indoctrinated all the time. So yeah, we prayed, we did, you know, we bowed to the picture of, it's like, I'm like, how much cult talk do I do and how much not cult talk? You know, we bowed to true parents. We bowed to the moon parents every night at my dad's house, every morning. And then we did Hunduke on Sundays. So we were like all in, but then when I was at my mom's house, we didn't do that. And so, and also one of my very closest church friends went to Korea for a year. Obviously, you know, like that happened a lot, like to get better at Korean, but also to be like more radicalized. So while she was gone, I really got close with my just public school friends. And I went in the opposite direction. And so then by high school, it was like, well, yeah, I'm already pretty much out the door here. And then I had a boyfriend and, you know, he mimicked some of the toxic dynamics that I'd grown up with my dad, you know, so it wasn't ideal, but it was still like, all right, and now I'm out. And then, yeah, I moved out of my dad's house when I was 15 over the boyfriend, actually.
Thank you for telling us that.
He had a photograph of, he caught, you know, I had everything hidden. My dad did a lot of like, find my journal and then have the audacity to read it and then have the audacity to like confront me about it, you know, which I'm sure is so normal in the church, but like other people would be appalled. Like he actually stole my journal and then gave it back to me on my birthday. Like it was a present. I was like, this is not a gift. I'm always like, I think back to how I was at that age and I'm so proud of me. I was 15 years old. He stole my journal. He gave it back. And I was like, this is not a gift. This is not a gift. This is not you giving. You shouldn't have taken it in the first place. Like my capacity to self-advocate, I am so proud of that. But anyway.
Wow. Good for you. Wow. Yeah. Good for you.
There was so much surveillance going on. And I think that's part of like, with all of the stuff going on in the world right now, with surveillance being so normalized with like apps and phones. Like I didn't have a smartphone until like 6 years ago because I hate surveillance so much. But like when I was 13 and 14, you know, like that's when AOL Instant Messenger got all exciting. You've got mail, or, you know, so supposedly all your conversations would disappear when you close the window. But my dad had some kind of program installed so that it's archived and saved all the conversations. And then he would just drop little tidbits in from our conversations just to show that he was listening. And it was always unclear to what extent and how far he was surveillancing. Like for a while, I thought the phone was tapped. I don't know if it was, but it was like just this constant, your privacy is not yours and you don't deserve it. And I know that I went further into the, I'm going to do whatever the fuck I want then direction rather than the, I'll be so good, you won't catch me doing anything direction. So I definitely, it didn't work very well. But yeah. So anyway, when I moved out of my dad's house, it was, he'd found this photograph after finding my journal of me and my boyfriend sort of snuggling on a slide. And he was like, I should rip that in half right now. And I was like, don't you dare. And I looked him in the eyes and then he smacked me in the face so hard, it like left a handprint for like the weekend. But my mom was right there, like right then ready to pick me up because it was her weekend. So we like left his house just on schedule. And then she's like, we should probably get a police report just in case he tries to fight you. Like, cause she was saying, you can stay at my house a little longer if you want. She was very, very analytical and almost, you know, like, do you hear the neutrality in that? It's like, she didn't want to impose any of her own opinions on it. It's like, just in case you want this, there was no like, all right, get the fuck out of here now. It was like, if in case he might do this later, you know? So even with that level of neutrality, at least she was advocating some, but then when the police came, they were like, you know, different parents discipline in different ways. So just speaking of toxic police officers and all the shit they do, there's a little tidbit of that. I had a handprint on my face, and they're like, well, every parent parents differently. It's like, okay. And statistically, lots of cops are also domestic abusers. Anyway, so that was, then I was at my mom's house for the weekend. And while I was gone, yeah, I said I'm an visual artist. So my whole bedroom was covered in my art when I got back on Monday. Cause I'm like, what if he does something weird? Literally everything in my room was gone, all gone. And thankfully the trash service hadn't come yet. So we found in the garage, all of my art crumpled and ripped in little balls. And we took all the trash bags from the garage. It was two of my friends. Actually, one of them was the one I had the woman I had the romance with, and a different friend, and then my boyfriend and my mom and my siblings. We just combed the whole house because my room was literally white. He had taken every single glow in the dark star off my ceiling. He had thrown away every single piece of art. He had thrown away my bed. And so we had to search the house to try to find my belongings. So that he literally moved me out of the house himself. Like it was like all of me was gone. But I was also simultaneously the eldest sibling babysitting my younger siblings every day. So he calls after doing that and he has the nerve. He's like, so did you start dinner? Like as if he hadn't done anything. And that was when I moved out of my dad's house. So.
Holy shit. I'm so sorry.
Anyway, all of that ties into threads with church stuff though, is what I realized, you know, like the church normalizes. It's like, oh, that's satanic shit. You know, that's satanic. You just better cut it off, like cut off that individuality and throw it away right away. And then, you know, they'll be better. So it's like, I feel like he was probably influenced by that in his decision to throw everything that was thrown away.
Yeah, he felt valid to get rid of you because you were worthless. You have a boyfriend. You ruined your purity. You can't get blessed or matched or go into heaven with them. So it's like,
well, I don't know. I think he was trying to get me to conform. I don't think his goal was actually to get rid of me. Wow. Like he was like, what? When I left and it didn't come back. But I think that he didn't feel prepared to fight my mom in court after everything that he'd done. I don't know how much he thought about it. But then every time he tried to hang out with me, he would just drop me off at the church house. Actually, the Amrine house. I'll just put that out there. He would drop me off at the Amrine house every time. He was like, let's go hang out. I was like, okay. And then he would just drop me off there. And then they would interrogate me about sex and stuff.
What? Okay.
Okay, maybe not sex. They would be like, they would lecture everyone about purity and sex. And then they would be like, you know, asking everyone if they were masturbating. That was okay. So I said earlier on how I would feel concerned about my friends. And honestly, I had it extremely normalized to be interrogated at the age of 16. I thought that was normal. But there were little kids there. And them being present and witnessing that interrogation, even with everything that was normalized for me, I'm like, this feels off and wrong. But I didn't feel from my position of, you know, being a discarded, fallen person, feel like I had the room to say anything or really do anything. Although I did once kind of like defy the top dog boss lady. I don't remember her actual name because we all called her Bujumnim, which I think means boss in Korean. But anyway, she was interrogating me at one point and I actually laughed while she was doing it, which really pissed her off. But there was part of me that was like, if I laugh in front of these children, maybe that will inspire some level of like rebellion in them. I don't know. It's not much. I didn't do much. I definitely feel like I have spent years feeling so much survivor guilt because I'm the oldest. And when I was 18, I just left. Like my mom helped me. You know, it wasn't like I just left with money in my pocket, never said hi again, but you know, I moved away and I pretty much stopped talking to my dad shortly after that with some, you know, I did a little bit of talking after that. But I had so much survivor guilt. Like why, when I moved into my mom, didn't I make all of my siblings go with me? Although at the same time, you know, like I said, she had so much neutrality, but what she set up was when we came across our own agency, she was there. So it's like she really set it up so that as soon as we were like, you know what, this is enough, she was like, okay. And then she supported that. And in some ways, I think that's pretty powerful in that when you're in a cult and you're used to being overpowered all the time, if someone else overpowers you, it can feel exactly the same, even if it's like, oh, I need to take you away from that. I mean, that's really complicated because shielding someone when they're a child is, I think, the right thing to do. But simultaneously, I guess, you know, like giving them agency and being like, well, what do you not like that? Okay, let's go, let's leave. Like there's some power to that too. But that's, even as an adult, when I see other people now and I'm like, that looks pretty fucked up. You can't overpower people out of situations. Like you have to honor their agency for them to feel like they have the ability to leave.
I came across this term, being an agent in your own rescue is a part of avoiding it being traumatic. Like if she just ripped you out of your house, you would have that trauma from being separated from your dad and not having your agency. But because you were willing to rescue yourself, that changed the whole script.
That's interesting. I don't know if I've heard being an agent in your own rescue, but yeah, I mean, I've experienced that as an adult, like interacting with people who are like in domestic violence situations or something like that. Like you can't force someone to leave when they're an adult. Children involved, that's a totally different story. But, you know, I feel like this podcast is primarily for cult survivors who are adults or cult survivors who are still in cults and thinking about it. And I just say, dig around for your agency and figure out what it's saying. You know, it's not, no one else can overpower you into anything, or they shouldn't. And so that's why I think people had such objection to some of the like deprogramming that they did back in the day, because that can be just as traumatizing and violating, and it's so complicated. And also like making the distinction between what's a cult and what's just really, really not aligned with my ethics and like all the other monotheistic abusive churches. It's subtle.
Yeah. I think that, you always make so much, there's so much to say about this one thing, but there is some abuse going on about the word cult. People are like saying, oh, the cult of TikTok, the cult of Instagram. Right. I'm like, no, like y'all are whitewashing the word and it's doing a disservice, like a major disservice. Some people are just using the word as a buzzword to get like attention. Yeah.
It's totally like, recreational.
You do not grasp the harm that is done in cults and how important it is to honor the survivor and to put in proper resources and terminology, because the new survivor can be very confused about, minimizing. Gosh. And then, okay. The Amrine House has been a big topic on this podcast. Do you want to talk about that anymore, or do you want to keep moving on?
I mean, pretty much what I said is all I can speak to for my firsthand experience. And I'm not one to speculate, especially because, like I said, I have friends who, you know, like, I feel like if you grew up in the DC church area, like the people in the Amrine House were just like, I don't think it was that huge of a like sensational. It was just like, yeah, you know, like I did go, you know, when home church was all the rage, that's when we started doing that more frequently as opposed to going to DC church. But, yeah, it's hard for me looking back knowing what is like more radicalized behavior and what's just mainstream church behavior, because it was a combination of I was already out, and when I wasn't, I was hanging out with Amrine folks. So it was like, yeah, I don't know what the like normal cult versus like radicalized cult bits, like the differences.
Gotcha. Can I ask some questions to clarify?
Okay.
Like I heard that the Amrine kids had to fundraise on the weekends.
I mean, they did a shit ton of fundraising. I wasn't there for that because, like I said, pretty much my dad would just sort of like dump me there when he had made me agree to hang out with him.
Okay.
And like I liked seeing my friends, and also I was worried about them, like legitimately. Yeah. But it was certainly not what I would have picked to do with my free time. You know, and I was a student and I had homework and I had friends, and if my dad was trying to spend time with me, I was like, why aren't you actually spending time with me? Like, why are you just leaving me here? He would go upstairs and like hang out with the dads while we were down there being grilled. It's like, this is not you hanging out with
me. That's so such a weird dynamic for your kids to be like, Bujangnim is asking about how much you masturbate. You guys are labor trafficked on the weekends.
Right.
That is a different flavor of cult than I was used okay. to. Just with the fundraising and the grilling. Yeah. We were told with a broad blanket statement during a lecture, like don't masturbate, don't touch yourself. It's evil, but like sure. not one-on-one interrogation. And if it was one-on-one,
it was group shaming. It would be grilling in front of other people.
Yeah. If it was group, if it was individual one-on-one, it was somebody just a few years older than you, somebody that just did FCF. Like, I don't remember getting grilled from like a 50-year-old woman, but I do remember
a bunch of little kids present.
Yeah. But I do remember they would send like an 18-year-old Annie to be like, hey, do you touch yourself? Cause that's wrong. Right. So they would work through this like grapevine stuff. But so I guess it's very similar. I guess it is very similar actually.
Yeah.
When I'm talking about it.
What was crazy for me too is my dad would like tell me, and I'm not going to say like details or anything, but he would tell me like what my siblings had reported during grill sessions to me when I wasn't even there. And that was just everybody's information. And he would like, so when he did actually spend time with me, that's what we would talk about. We would like walk around the lake and he'd be holding my hand. And then he'd start telling me about what my siblings could confess about masturbating while he's holding my hand. And I would literally like leave my body in my hand. I would just sort of like, all right, now I'm not hanging out in my hand anymore while holding his hand. It was just so fucking weird. I was like, why are you telling me this? Oh my God. I did not know what to do.
You're bringing up visceral memories for me, visceral memories. This is like, making my soul leave my body. Cause I have vague memories like this.
Yeah.
What is it called? When you pit your kids against each other, also you're the oldest and there's no boundaries and I'm sorry.
Well, he was describing it as like development. He was almost saying it like pride. It was like, not even pitting us against each other. Maybe it was, but it was like, oh, here's the progress that so-and-so, you know, your sibling made, I don't know what they called the grill sessions. I can't remember. There's a lot of stuff.
Confession.
There's a lot reporting. Of stuff I don't remember.
It was called reporting. Actually,
so my, I don't feel like naming him right now, but my dad, you can figure out who he is pretty easily because he made a website. He like had a website that had pretty much all of the sermons on them. And it's actually super handy for when you want to unpack more of what was stuffed down your throat. You can go back and look at the sermons, but I actually searched for my own name in his little search bar. And I found one of his own personal accounts about like taking me when I was like 13 years old to be like lectured at like, I think we were supposed to show up for Hundoke at 5 to see River Moon, but it was like a 2-hour drive. So I had to wake up at like maybe 2 a.m. or 3 a.m. And I could go look it up. But anyway, it's really like, I know that I was in sermons at like all hours of day or night. And we lived in DC, so we got to see Sun Myung Moon all the time. You know, like it wasn't like, you know, some people live more remotely, so then it's like, oh my God. But, and I'm not saying it was still exciting to me. Like I still sort of had this like reverence. I was like, oh yeah, I'm sitting here, I'm being solemn. I actually think I realize now that maybe not everybody's in that headspace. I was always in this really like reverent, like listening super devotedly to like all the translations. And then when his turn to talk, it was all Korean. I was like listening for the emotional feeling of it. I was not tuning it out at all. I was very much like drinking all of it, which is crazy because it was so many different toxic things. But anyway,
I love you bring up the intrigue because there is an intrigue when someone's speaking another language. There's extra layer of curiosity. Like, oh, what is he saying? I understand that.
He was so passionate. He was always so fucking I mean, he was pissed. Like most of his, he was just like raging at us.
He was also gross. Do you remember his tongue? He would always stick his tongue out at.
Oh my God.
Oh God.
And he was always like talking about, you know,
sex,
genitalia. He was just talking about, and every so often he'd say it in English just to get the point across. And he like he'd name the sexual anatomy in English and then go back to Korean.
Yeah.
Just to like get it across. But
yeah,
I guess my segue to all of that was that there's so much I don't remember, but just looking my name up once on my dad's search bar, it's like an account of taking me when I'm 13 years old to be told like, you need to save yourselves to be blessed, not only to be blessed, but preferably to be blessed to someone who does not speak your language. That was this particular sermon was like, you need to be able to learn how to love. Like, God, it was like the setup for so much. Anyway,
human trafficking, it's kind of, lack of agency.
Yes,
no boundaries.
Kind of validating when I can't, you know, because I never sensationalized the church. It's almost like I just brushed it aside. I didn't save a ton of details because it was no big deal to me. So then when I'm like, man, I feel like that happened to me all the time. Like I feel like I was up at like every hour, odd hour of the day at a sermon at random times, but I don't really know. And then I go search my little name in his little search bar on his website and it's right there. It's like, yeah, I got her up at, you know, 2 so that we could drive there by 5. I'm like, yep, that's what I did when I was 13. Also, he was like, yeah, she was one of the youngest ones. Most of them were like 15 and 16. It's like, yeah, I was 13 years old. What was I doing at 2 a.m. being told to marry someone who didn't speak my language? But the funky part is that I was like, I had that intrigue, like you said, I had that reverence, but I simultaneously I cannot actually remember visualizing myself getting matched. I can't actually remember ever thinking it was going to happen. There was some part of me that just didn't even buy into it a little bit, but I also simultaneously treated him like this prophet to be curious about.
We went so deep. If you have any, you know, if you want to retract any of that, you let me know. But yeah. I think that was amazing. One question about the Amrine house is, did Reverend Moon visit it?
Oh man, I don't think I can be the fact checker on that.
Okay, no problem. We'll glaze right over that. And then,
okay.
And all the moms were gone. Is that right? All the moms were in Korea.
I know there were there some. I can't talk on that timeline either.
No problem. You were 13. That is your experience.
Yeah. I mean, when I was later after I moved out, I moved out from my dad's at 15. And then later on, that's when he would drop me off there, like 16 and 17 and 18. But I don't remember very well. And I don't know, because I was not there even any kind of majority of the time. It was so random. So I couldn't speak to how frequently he was there.
Okay, cool. Well, let's go back to Sean Moon, when we were breaking out into this, there's something I wanted to say about what Sean Moon is doing to his mother, similar to what your dad did to your mom, similar to what all men do to all women in the Unification Church and other monotheistic religions, is villainizing women's agency. Something that Sean Moon is preaching is that Hak Ja-Han slept with the devil and is no longer his mother and is no longer the true mother. This is similar and very likened to the Salem witch trials.
Yes.
So I am seeing in real time in 2022, people believing by the thousands that this could be possible. And I want to say how dangerous it is for the followers of Moon for the followers of Sean Moon to believe that a woman could lose her age, like just her authority, her position, anything. I'm not saying Hak Ja-Han's innocent. She is just as dangerous. She's done just as much harm. But the fact that Sean could say simply, she slept with the devil, like, can you imagine how many other people will reflect that ideology in their own families and be like, well, your mom's no longer legitimate because she's Lucifer. So let's just burn her at the stake.
Right. Yeah. It's funny because it does bring up complicated emotions. Because obviously Hak Ja-Han's complicit, and you know, she fucking worked her ass off to get there, and her son's just like, hold on, let me just reference gender real quick. All right, my turn. You know, it's like, dude, back off. This is her abusive empire, not yours. I don't know. I'm kind of laughing at it, maybe where I shouldn't, but
Absolutely. So in human trafficking, I looked up this term is when kids get groomed, because Hak Jeon was picked at 13. She was 13 yeah. when Reverend Moon, who was married with children, saw her and was like, you're going to be my bride. 13. Yeah. I don't know how much later it was that he actually impregnated her, but it was like maybe 16, 17. Still, she's a child bride of a 40-year-old man. So she was groomed, and then the 7-year course happened where she was thoroughly broken and like mm-hmm. Stockholm syndrome, all that, impregnated multiple times. I think she lost her third child because she was raped and impregnated too fast.
Oh my God.
Anyways, she overcame that, thoroughly broke her. In terms of human trafficking, she was trafficked as a child. She was harvested for babies, and then she graduated and she became complicit in her abuse and became the trafficker. This is a very common structure of human trafficking. So I'm not defending Hak Jeon. I think all of it's awful, but just like what you said with Sean pulling the gender card. And like, this is dangerous. I just want to say how dangerous this is for like the next wave of Moonies and whatever that looks like. It's going to be tied in with the oppression of women, with the overturn of Roe versus Wade, with how much influence Sean has in America with the gun laws and the right wing extremists, him also pulling the gender shit and demonizing his mom as well as all women. I don't know. It doesn't look like his wife can say anything. Like, I'm scared.
Yeah, I am too. And it feels scary to even admit being scared. Like even just speaking, you know, and like laughing off my own experiences and naming my own agency and naming all the things that I know are considered evil, like it's still scary now, even though I don't buy in at all to any of it. I'm still, you know, it's effective intimidation. That's what it is.
Yeah. I just wanted to come on and regulate, cause like for the last couple of days I've been like, first the Roe versus Wade overturned, and that just really overstimulated my nervous system. And then Sean is like trying to strong arm in Japan and pull members, and Hak Jeon's been missing for a few weeks. Like nobody knows where she is. So I don't know if she like had a stroke or is debilitated or is just sick or has pneumonia and can't talk. I don't know what's going on, but Sean's making power plays. And a lot of people won't see how this plays into the world stage. But like as an ex-Moonie, who knows the influence that the Moonies have globally?
Right.
It does worry me. And then I have to like refocus and be like, well, what can I do? I can't save the world. Let's get rid of the hero complex. But what can I do to recenter myself and just do what I can? And so this podcast, like, I'm so happy you were like, let's call tomorrow. I was like, I can't. And then the schedule worked out, and I'm like, thank God, I needed this. I needed to speak with someone to regulate, because it's just so much chaos.
It is a lot. And it just the timing of all of it, like I said, for the 40 years late, and I know a lot of blessings happened, and I don't have them all memorized. I'm not like I don't know all the statistics. I'm not like a nerd over everything of it. Not to diss nerds. Nerds are awesome. But I'm just saying, I don't know all the details of all the different blessings or anything like that. I just remember that blessing in 1982 feeling like a big deal, and like it broke the Guinness World Book of Records. And I also remember, like, when I was a kid, freaking adults out when they would be like, oh, like, how do your parents meet? Or I don't even, something even more innocuous than that. But I would throw the mass blessing at them just to see their response, because I thought it was so funny. And like, when you do that now, most people don't know what I'm talking about. But when I was a kid, everybody knew what I was talking about. And that was kind of entertaining, to be honestly.
I think with the Madison Square, because you could just say Madison Square and everybody knew, it legitimized us in the worldview. And also from a crazy cult with a bunch of kids fundraising, it turned into families. And you can't just, you just can't break apart families. And it just legitimized that this is going down in history. Because we're going to have kids and then generationals, like
and
trauma.
And part of what's intense about that too is like, people like to ask you hypothetical questions. People ask so many people, you know, like adoption, you know, like, for example, the way abortion's being weaponized, adoption survivors who weren't aborted are like being interrogated. Like, well, would you rather have not been born? It's like, how about you fuck off with your hypothetical question? And, you know, same with the church. Like, my parents were matched and now I exist. And a lot of my favorite people exist. That doesn't invalidate or discredit or take away from the harm that was done. And what repair can we do now is a much more practical question than would you rather not exist? So it's weird because it's shaped me quite literally into existing in a lot of people who were dear to me when I was a very little kid, you know, like my best friend when I was born till when I was seven, she was born in the church too, and her parents were matched. And she had like super sweet parents. I love them. I haven't seen them in a really long time, but it's weird to, yeah, once you have families involved, it becomes a lot more complicated. You can't just extract people back out. And then you have to sit with it in a much more complex way. And I think in some ways that's part of why I had the reverence witnessing Sun Myung Moon, even though it was like I didn't buy in. I think it was because I knew I was participating in history. Like, if you think of all the prophets historically, my whole issue with most of them is how they'll be like, okay, those previous prophets, they had some points, but prophecies end with me. And that's not unique to Reverend Moon. Like, so many prophets will say, okay, here, God was talking, now God's done talking. It's like, why do you have to put the bookend on that? And that, especially because part of the theology of the Unification Church was like, it broke up the binary of heaven and hell, which I really appreciated. Like, the spirit world was super complex. And I'm like, yeah, I agree with that. And like, yeah, all the prophets were really complex. I'm like, yeah, I agree with that too. But then it's like, but I'm the last one. I'm like, okay, well, that doesn't make any sense. And also all of these, all of the, just so many of the ways that truisms are manipulated into control. You know, it's like, of course, having a loving family is good. So the church trying to base itself on, let's be loving families. It's like, well, why would you argue with that? It's like, well, it's how you implement it. It's like, who's involved? You know, it's like the way that women are supposed to be subordinate, the way that children are supposed to, like, you know, they're like pedestaled, but simultaneously have no boundaries or control over their lives. So it's funny because I have a child who's literally knocking on the door right now because I'm hanging out in her space because it's the quietest part of the house and she wants her space back. And so it's like, I have a really nourishing family and partnership. And it's really funny because it's ironic because it's like, I went pretty much the total opposite direction of the church and I wasn't striving that as a goal. And so it feels like this random irony to have like a pretty wholesome, healthy family, in my estimation. I mean, it's like, I'm queer, my partner is queer, and we sometimes develop like romantic feelings for other people. And, you know, we're definitely not bread and butter, like Bible Belt family values, but we're a very sweet family. And it's just strange and ironic because it feels so much healthier than anything I saw growing up. So there's this whole argument, like, we need to restore families. It's like, okay, well, you don't do that by coercively controlling and shaming everyone. It's like, yeah, everyone starved for true parents. Like, that was the fucking talking point. Like, if you radicalize a bunch of traumatized people from all over the world and promise them something that they didn't have, that'll work for a while. The part where it's still working on some people, that's sad for me. Because the selling points aren't real. They're not real.
Yeah.
It's not wholesome. It's not functional families. I've known so many abuse survivors in the church, and I'm one of them. And I know so many domestic survivors in the church, and my mom is one of them. And yeah, the selling points are false. I mean, you could say that for the political debate that's going on in the United States right now too.
So the terminology that I think is appropriate for what you're describing is called future faking, I believe.
That's a good one. Thank you.
Yeah, yeah, future faking. Chan Il-guk era is going to be in 7 years. Oh, another yeah. 7. Oh, you guys right. You guys fucked it up. It'll be another 15 years. Yeah. Like, that's, yeah, future faking. Man, okay, so it sounds like you got to get going, and I really appreciate everything we've talked about. I just really appreciate you sharing so honestly, just because, like, I haven't heard anybody affirm what it's like to be a kid of, like, well, not, I have heard some people, but the more I hear these stories, the more empowered I feel about being, like, a stigmatized blessed child with being fallen and then having your mom leave. That kind of stuff is really yeah. empowering. So thank you for taking that shame, because you telling that story and then telling us you landed in a place, ironically, of a happy family, just like yeah. is really comforting and hopeful and kind of breaks, takes off a couple layers of shame. So I appreciate you doing yeah. that.
Well, thank you so much for talking so much, and also for holding this space for me specifically on the 40 years later. I felt like I just, for some reason, my energetic need was like, I need to hold this today. And I just have this visual of, I think of my origin story in the aerial view of the imagery. Like, I've never seen it, but I just imagine everyone leaving Madison Square Garden afterward and what that looked like, and just all of the black and white bodies like flooding the streets. And it's just been something that's been stuck in my head. So I felt like I needed to hold that today, and just some church stuff. And it's intense naming my sexuality so irreverently. Like, I'm just like laughing it off. I'm like, yep, I think it's important, especially with how coercive it feels like the national scale continues to be, not just in the church. Like you're saying, the coordination between the Moon family and the larger geopolitical landscape, like, I don't even know as much about that as I should, but I know that it's related, and it is scary. And I guess, you know, intimidation, yeah, it's scary, but also laughing off the coercive tactics is all I feel like I can manage to do. And like, really, you know, learn your body, learn your intuition, learn your freaking ovulation cycles, get your wisdom and your mutual aid and your community going on, because this is a rough ride right now.
Absolutely. I'll just throw out a little bit for period cycles. If your vaginal discharge is sticky like an egg white, girls, that means you're fertile. Like,
that's called spin.
Yeah. Like, just,
that's called spin. Yep.
So that's okay. Yeah. Anyways, that's just because this podcast is all over the place. But
yes, I like hopping everywhere.
I love that we identified the legitimacy, the landmark, the historical landmark of the legitimacy of our genetics, Reverend Moon performed he eugenics, mass eugenics.
Yes.
It's Madison Square Garden, and today is the historical landmark of that day. And so it's beautiful how it's all colliding, and how we felt so drawn to do this podcast, because I needed it just as much as you did. I needed just something in me, and my soul was like very hyperactive and very alarmed. And so it's just really interesting how it's all converging today and regulating. Yeah, and giving wisdom, bodily wisdom about periods.
It's important. Yes. And I definitely want to keep talking to you, like we already have been for over a year. Like, just in general, I love co-processing, and I love all of our mutual reference points. Like, you have a parent who was, like, parents were divorced, and you're an artist, and all these different reference points.
Awesome. It's cool. It's pretty cool.
Thank you.
It's just funny to
holding this. It's a lot. My phone is dying.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm trying to think of how to sort of gracefully leave.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for everything. I appreciate you sharing, and I look forward to releasing this and having it be a safe place for people to land. Wherever they are and whatever we talked about.
Okay, and that is my interview with Nicole. I again want to thank her so much for coming on and being brave to tell her story. trust yourself, trust your intuition. Your body knows best. And take care of your mental health. We will talk again soon.